Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome back. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that this is a two-hour show, but if you've just joined us, I want to let you know that in the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics instead of focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. And in this, the second hour, we balance the creative with the intellectual by featuring in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. The show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. If you'd like to find out more about the show, you can go to the website. It's aquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all past shows there, and you can also connect with me on social media, should you so wish. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Tom Killian, woodcut and letterpress artist and founder of Quail Press. Born and raised in Mill Valley, California, on the slopes of Mount Tamalpais, Tom was inspired from an early age to create landscape prints using linoleum and wood, strongly influenced by the traditional Japanese ukiyo-e style of hokusai and hiroshige. He studied history at UC Santa Cruz, where he was introduced to fine book printing by William Everson and Jack Stauffacher. And in 1975, he produced his first illustrated book on UCSC's Cowell Press. After traveling extensively in Europe and Africa, Killian returned to Santa Cruz, California in 1977 and founded his own Quail Press, where he published his second book, Fortress Marin. Since his first illustrated book in 1975, Tom has continued producing extensively illustrated books, including 28 Views of Mount Tamalpais, The Coast of California, and Walls, A Journey Across Three Continents, which draws on his experiences working as administrator of a medical relief program in a camp for Ethiopian refugees in Sudan and traveling with nationalist rebels in war-torn Eritrea. Along with publishing fine art letterpress books, Tom holds a PhD in African history from Stanford University and has taught at Bowdoin College, Maine and San Francisco State University, in addition to being a Fulbright Scholar at Asmara University in Eritrea. He has collaborated with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Schneider on three books, The High Sierra of California, Tamalpais Walking, and the recently released California's Wild Edge, The Coast in Poetry, History, and Prints. Tom is currently working on landscape prints, including treescapes, coastal and mountain views, at his studio located on Inverness Ridge near Point Reyes, California. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Ruth.
Well, you've said that you were inspired from an early age by traditional Japanese art. I'm wondering where you were first exposed to this kind of art.
Well, I grew up in the Bay Area, and there's a lot of East Asian art around the Bay Area. And when I was a child, I was fortunate that my mother took me to some shows of East Asian art in San Francisco. I think the first thing I saw was some of those wonderful scrolls of mountains and rivers, sort of Sung Dynasty Chinese landscape paintings, all the little trails and river gorges and mist and mountains. And then somehow I also got interested in Hokusai's landscapes, and especially his series on Mount Fuji. And somebody in my family gave me a little book of those prints, I think, when I was around 10 or 12. So I wanted to do things that looked like that. And I started with pen and ink, and after a while I started using linoleum to do little woodcut or linoleum cut prints in those days of Mount Tamalpais when I was a teenager.
What appealed to you visually about this art form? Because it's quite stylized in a way, isn't it?
Well, all art is stylized. I think, you know, European landscape tradition is probably more stylized than the Japanese one. The East Asian landscape tradition really is a brush painting medium, so it's a different kind of marking to our eye. But other than that, they try to deal with the real forms of trees and the different plant life and the geology and the mountains and rivers and coastline of where they live. And it looks pretty accurate, really. It's just that when you carve it into wood in reverse, you know, then you get into a lot of other markings and things look a little different. But I'm not sure that it's that different a style than any other style of art. It's really pretty literal interpretation of landscape.
Right. I suppose I was thinking it's not a sort of realist form in a way, is it? I mean, like, a sort of photographic style. I mean, I think it's incredibly beautiful. I guess that's what I was trying to mean by saying it's somewhat stylized.
Oh, no, I know what you mean. Yeah. I'm coming from my friend Gary Snyder's take on it.
Uh-huh.
He really fell in love with Japanese and Chinese landscape painting when he was younger also. And he thought, having traveled more extensively in Asia than I have, he thought that it really was pretty accurate to the places and the vegetation that it was portraying. Within that, you know, that particular way of painting with a brush that's a little different than the old European style.
Yeah, yeah. What drew you to making woodcut prints rather than becoming a painter, for example?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I always was very partial to things that had to do with line. I always was interested in line when I was really young. I have a natural ability in art, I guess, visual art. So I drew since I was a child, and I particularly liked looking at line drawings and etchings. You know, I remember loving Dürer when I was young. The English woodcut tradition appealed to me, and all the book arts, and then you know, like I say, I was very interested in Japanese landscape prints. From the classical period, the ukiyo-e period, you know, the 1820s and 30s especially, Hokusai and Hiroshige. So I guess it's the line quality. And in woodcut, you really get this incredible hard edge and, you know, these beautiful dark lines and big spaces of sort of consistent color because of the inking process.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's something about that, the sort of the visual quality of that that's more intense, maybe, that appealed to me.
Mm.
Whatever it is, I liked it.
Yeah. Woodcut's an interesting process. You could say, in a way, it involves the right and the left brain because of the artistic and the technical aspects. I mean, obviously, all art has some technical aspect, but, you know, with the printing press and the cutting of the wood and everything, you know, it does involve sort of left and right brain. Do you think that's part of the appeal to you?
Yeah, I don't know anything about psychological theories, but but certainly it is a mixture of what we like to call craft and what we like to call art. You know, somewhere along the line, so I'm going to go off on a tangent here.
Uh-huh.
And excuse me to any artists that happen to be listening that it's not that I'm conservative or anything, but I'm going to go off on a little tangent, standing up for the craft side of art.
Mm-hmm.
You got to remember, until the camera was invented in the two-dimensional visual arts, there was the highest praise was given to art that was evocative of real life and, you know, sometimes very, very accurate, sometimes, you know, decorative, but still very evocative of it. And there was a lot of craft in trying to get that look on a two-dimensional medium, paint, drawing, whatever it is. So artists were very fine craftsmen. And so were the Impressionists, who started to, because the camera had come along, they didn't have to be quite as accurate. Mm-hmm. But then something happened in the early 20th century with this sort of idea that got released around the big change in Western culture at the end of World War I, that art should be done in a more intuitive, way, led into abstract art. So now we have in popular mythology, popular understanding of art, that it should be done very quickly and from some other place in the mind other than craftsmanship, mm-hmm. And you see, a lot of stuff that is amazing from geniuses, and an incredible amount of stuff that's really far less than amazing from people that don't have that ability. That's an unusual ability to just out there and do something very quickly and have it really work. So if you're going to take time and do craftsmanship, it's a whole nother thing. Mm. And you have to think it through, and you have to work with the process and learn your medium and your tools and put in your 10,000 hours, as they're saying these days, right? You got to put in 10,000 hours. Well, I've certainly put in a lot more than 10,000 hours, and it takes a long time to learn how to do any craft, well, and you can only do so many in your life. So,
yeah.
I got fortunate in liking this early, starting to learn it, and just taking it off in my own direction. If I had gone to art school, I probably would have, gotten sort of distracted by all the other possibilities out there. But yes. I never went to art school, so I never learned how to do anything else. I taught myself this pretty much.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm not a good person to talk to about where it's at in terms of art. I just know this one thing. But the one thing I know is that this craft of printmaking has great potential to free up the artist to sort of follow this very intuitive organic development that takes place in the making of a print, because there's so many processes and steps you go through, you lose even though it seems very controlled, you truly really lose control over the overall look of the process when you're getting in, at least the way I work, into a real multi-block, a multi-color print, a project that takes 6 months or so.
Mm, yeah.
Because first, I go out and I work with a sketch. So I'm in the place drawing the lines that I see. I never work from photographs. So if Hokusai didn't do it, then I don't do it. And of course, there were no cameras in 1820. So I do a sketch, and that sketch becomes the basis for the print, but it's just a bunch of lines. I write notes about color. I don't usually do color studies with watercolor or anything. And then I do all the main lines of the print come from the sketch I have being reversed directly onto the first block, the key block. And then once that block is carved, I reverse that onto a bunch of other blocks, as many as I'm going to need for the different colors, so I can accurately carve, the different color areas to fit together when I go and print. And then I lay down the first color. And the first color sort of determines where the whole print's going to go. So I've learned that on the day that I put down the first color, I had better not be in a bad mood or distracted, by something else. I've really got to be there and concentrate and think about where I want this print to go. And even though I understand how the different layers of color are going to interact with each other, I know that underlying color is going to be critical. And sometimes I get it a little different, and I have to spend the whole print trying to recover from that first color choice. And it'll send me off in a totally different direction. And as the color layers build up, I start to see where the print is going itself. It's as if the print starts to take on its own life and starts telling me where to go. And I know painters that do this too. They put down some paint and then they come back the next day and they look at it and they take it somewhere else. And they work that way, especially in abstract painting. But for me, there's this there's this one side of it that's very accurative, looks very figurative, you know, really seems to be related to the landscape. And on the other hand, the color part of it particularly really goes off into its own direction. So at the end, I get something quite different than maybe what I had at first envisioned the
right.
print being, which is really fun. It can also be very frustrating.
Yeah. Well,
but you have to learn how to go with it and see where it's going and then just go off in that direction.
Yeah.
And that is a wonderful thing because it seems like a very controlled process, and in some ways it is, but at the same time, it really frees me up. You know, I don't know how it would work with other people, but for me, it frees me up to just kind of take a very intuitive, organic approach to how this is developing rather than try to impose some kind of control over exactly where it's going.
Yeah.
It ends up looking controlled, but actually there's a lot of serendipity and just coincidence in there.
Right. Well, I look forward to hearing more about your process. We need to go to a break now. If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest, Tom Killian.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, this is Jackie from Integrity Event Planning. Are you coordinating an event? Don't know how you'll get it all done? Stop sweating the small stuff. We plan everything from family events to fundraising and corporate events. Contact Integrity Event Planning for your next event. Check out our website, integrityeventplanning.com. Integrity, it's what sets us apart. With 16 years of experience, we negotiate with your bottom line and needs in mind. So sit back and relax and let us serve the champagne. We've got this.
For your next event, visit integrityeventplanning.com. That's integrityeventplanning.com.
Dream, baby, dream.
It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, Tom Killian, woodcut and letterpress artist. Before the break, you were talking a bit about the process that you use for your art. And I just wondered if we could go into a little bit more detail about that. For those of us who are not familiar with this process of making prints, you know, you were talking about how you make, you know, you carve the first one and then the second one. Could you just go into a little bit more detail of how many of those carvings you need to do, and then how that works in the press. You know, how does it all end up being the print at the end?
Well, of course, this is better seen than explained on the radio. But
well, briefly,
I'll try.
Okay.
and please break in if something you think needs a little better explanation.
Okay.
But you know, there's two things going on with making a woodcut print. The first thing is to get all the lines there, and you can do a single color print. So in that, all you have to do is reverse your the image that you want to do onto the block. If it's a landscape, you want to look like what you've drawn.
So when you say reverse, you're looking at your drawing and having to draw it backwards onto the wood. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but of course you don't draw it backwards. What you do is you put a piece of tracing paper over the original sketch. This is how I do it. Uh-huh. I like that better than transfer paper. There's things called transfer paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
Too. But anyway, I put a piece of tracing paper over the sketch and tape it down and go over every line with a very soft pencil. And then I take the tracing paper and turn it upside down and tape it down onto my first block, which is going to be the key block. And I go over the back of each line. I can see it through the tracing paper with a ballpoint pen, and I press that pencil line into the wood. So when I pull the tracing paper off, there is the whole image kind of in a soft pencil, kind of lightly on the wood. And then I work that whole thing up. I redraw all the lines with ballpoint pen. And if I'm going to add markings for patterns, I put them in there on the block. And I pretty much draw everything before I carve it, all the lines. I find that that works better for me. If I'm just doing a single color print, then it's all about finding markings and texture patterns that are going to give the illusion of the landscape that I'm looking at.
Right.
And if you look at my work, you'll see that over the 40 or so years I've been doing this, I've developed my own little marking vocabulary, I call it, of different little things that give you the illusion you're looking at coastal chaparral, say, or bay trees versus redwood trees, and different kinds of water and sky patterns and all the rest. And so, you know, to develop those marking patterns is kind of a fun little, absolutely intuitive, not really thought through with whichever side of the brain you were talking about. I'm not sure which side that would be. you know, and you know, that's one of the creative things you do. Now, if you're going to get into color, you've got a whole other thing that's going on. So if you want to do color, you're going to take your initial block that has the lines on it, and that block will become more or less the template for the whole color print. And in the Japanese key block technique, which I sort of use a modified version of, basically the outline of everywhere there's going to be one color butting up against another color, there's a line there to tell you where that is. So if you're going to have clouds in the sky, you need to have lines showing where the clouds are, even if those clouds in the end aren't going to be the black color that the key block usually is. To start with, you've got to have this template. And once you get that key block done, you ink it up, and I print it onto Mylar because it doesn't squeeze and change and move around the way some other, like acetate or tracing paper and things like that do. And while the ink's still wet, I turn the Mylar over and tape it down onto an uncut wood block and rub the back of it, and I get the whole image reversed onto that block. And I do that for as many blocks as I think I'm going to need for the print. Now, I don't make as many blocks as I'm going to have colors in the print, because I can do another thing called reduction cut later on, where once I get to the printing stage, I print the first pass off the color block in a light color maybe, and then I'll go back and recarve that block and print it a second time in a darker color that goes right over the previous color. And I can do that two, three, sometimes as much as four times. And in the end, I'll have just one little piece left of that block that's a printing surface still. So that's the reduction cut process. Now there is printmaking that just uses a single block and does multiple reductions on it. Suicide reduction cut, that's called. Those are really extraordinary prints. I don't work that way. I kind of do what I call multi-block reduction cut on my big multicolor prints.
So it's called suicide because if you do it wrong, then the whole thing is over.
Yeah, well, you start, you lay down a color, and then you just keep cutting away. And, you know, and if you do something you don't like, you know, then...
Too bad.
Yeah, the only option is suicide. But anyway.
That sounds very bleak. So each block, that you, as you put the colors down, I'm looking at the cover of your new book, California's Wild Edge, and in the top right, there's kind of like a pale green on the top of the cliffs. So you might have on your color block, you would just be putting on that block the pale green wherever it appears in the whole picture, and then you run that through the print press to get that color onto the original one that you did. Is that how it works?
Yeah, more or less. But we're getting ahead because we're talking about printing.
Okay.
So let me just get all the colors done for you now. So I've got the key block done. And then I get all the first layer that's going to come from all the color blocks. I get those all carved. And this is the most amount of time in the whole process, is doing all that carving. The key block can take a week sometimes if it's got a lot of detail. And the color blocks take 1 or 2 days each, sometimes more if they have lots of detail. And so for a big multicolor print like that one on the cover of the book that had, I think, in the end, 14 layers of color on it, you know, we're talking about a month or two of carving to get it ready.
Wow.
And then I get to the printing. So then with the printing, I have my little hand-cranked Asburn cylinder-proof press that was made for printing type originally, but it works very good for wood blocks. And it has grippers that hold the paper onto the cylinder that rolls over the bed of the press. And in the bed of the press, you can lock in your wood blocks, and then they have the printing surface on them. Everything that's been carved away isn't going to print, so the printing surface is what you leave. And then you have these rubber rollers that are in a carriage that travels in front of that cylinder, so it inks the blocks as you crank the cylinder over. So before the paper comes, first goes on the ink. And on those rubber rollers, I can set up gradated rolls where, you know, it can be darker at one end and get down to lighter and change colors. And you can see that in my skies and my seas particularly, but I do it on tint blocks behind some of the landscape parts as well. And so that gives you great variety of color that you can put down. And, of course, the inking rollers, which are big rubber rollers, put the ink on very smoothly, so you get this beautiful flow of color, which is one of the appealing things about printmaking. It is a different look from anything that's painted with printmaking, where the ink is squeezed onto the paper, the pressure of the printing. So first it's rolled onto the block, then the block is essentially like the paintbrush, and then it's squeezed onto the paper with the pressure of the printing. And that's the look that that I think is so appealing to me and the people about things that are done on a printing press from a plate.
You're having to hold an incredible amount in your mind of what the finished image is going to be, because, you know, obviously if you were like painting a picture, as you lay color on, you see what is happening and you can modify that or work with that. But in this process, you know, you're really having to have those sort of visual images in your mind projected forward, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's why it takes years to get good at it, I guess, because I started, for years, I just did single color prints. So that's easier to visualize. You're just carving all the lines into the block, and you know that what you carve away is going to be white, and then what you leave is going to be the color, you know, black or dark blue or something is what I usually use. And when you get into the color layers, it becomes much more complicated. So the way to start doing colors is to just do a few tints sort of behind the different, black key block. So you have patterns of lines. You can see the color coming through behind it. And then to get into the full color thing, you really have to work your way up to that over several years, because you have to learn how to visualize where it's going. At least visualize it a little bit. As I said previously, it doesn't always come out how you expect, and you learn to just go with what colors are developing, just the way a painter does. A painter does that too, especially in abstracts.
Yeah. This is a very traditional way of making art. Do you see it as a living tradition that is still growing?
Well, certainly for me it is. I have no idea how people approached it. I've read about how people do it. I've seen a couple of little videos of traditional Japanese printmaking. I did visit the studio of one of the great Japanese landscape printmakers in the 1980s in Tokyo, and watched his crew of printers producing a multi-block print. Because in the traditional Japanese printmaking, the artist designs the print, but skilled block carvers do the carving, and skilled printers do the printing. And it's a very labor-intensive process, because everything's done by hand. The printing is all done by hand, not with a printing press.
Right, yeah.
So, I sort of adapted some of the things I read to using oil-based inks and a printing press, but I still use the Japanese carving tools. But I do all the carving, so I'm kind of more directly involved in the printmaking as an art than it truly is a craft in the way the traditional Japanese print was made. The creative part is pretty much the artist, and then often the publisher would make the decisions, from what I've read about the colors. The artist will make notes, and then the publisher will make the actual decisions about the colors. And then the craftspeople, who are very skilled, do the carving. And they carve just to the lines of the artist. And then the printers do the printing, and they use the colors just as they're directed by the publisher.
Right. So you're much more in control of the finished art product, because you're doing all the different aspects.
Yeah. And of course, today in modern Japan, there are a lot of people that work by themselves and have adapted things too. But I am constantly inventing new little things, and the fun of it is how it's always challenging and interesting, and you can set up little challenges for yourself without saying I'm setting up a challenge for myself. But you just, every time I want to do some new kind of scene with some new landscape feature in it, say, that I haven't dealt with before, I have to figure out a way to do that. And one of the fun things about this California's Wild Edge book project is dealing with the sea, which, of course, is always changing and different, and trying to get movement, and the kind of light that comes off the sea is really a wonderful challenge. And especially in a hard-edged medium like woodblock print, it's endlessly fascinating. So I've did so many overlays of color on some of these multicolor prints to get the effects I wanted. And of course, a lot of them just went off in their own direction, not exactly where I'd first intended it.
But I can imagine.
Yeah, but at the end, you can adjust things with the reduction cut technique. You always still have your blocks, and you can go, even after you've printed the key block, over the whole thing, which is usually the end of the print, the final thing you do. So let me actually backtrack and just say, so when I get to the printing, I lay down the lightest color first, and then I'll go through and I'll print all the layers, the first layers off the different color blocks I have. And I do these on what are called registration proofs, where I've printed the key block in some sort of lighter, different color than what the final key block color is going to be. I printed it on a bunch of pieces of paper in exactly the position that I want it to be on my edition paper. And then I run those papers through to get the color blocks perfectly positioned before I switch to the edition paper. So I get these you know, it's like first things will be off a little bit, and I have to move stuff around, and there's hours spent adjusting the print, and at the same time I'm thinking about how is this color turning out, and adjusting the colors I'm putting on, you know, fixing the gradated rolls so that they go from dark to light the way I want them, and all that. Get it all set up, and then finally, when it's all set up, I switch to my edition paper, which is this handmade Japanese paper that I have specially made in big batches for me.
Oh, wow.
In Japan. And then I start printing the first layer of color. So I have a white piece of paper, and on it goes that first layer of color. And I'll start with usually, you know, in a landscape print, it'll probably be the sky or a very light colored tint block that's going to go behind some part of the land. Or if there's water, maybe a light tint behind the water. And then I have to print the whole, everything that I want. So I have a stack of paper there that's as many sheets as I'm going to hopefully have in my edition. Always a few extra. The more layers of color, the more extra sheets I have to have, because you always make mistakes.
Yeah.
And then I run them all through, which takes hours, and keep adding ink. And so there's slight changes every single print when you get into the multicolor prints. Every one is slightly different because I'm adding ink by hand and adjusting things as I go along.
We need to go to a commercial break now. I'm sorry, Tom. I want to really hear more about that, and I really want to talk more about your new book, California's Wild Edge. So we'll be going back to Tom in a few minutes. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. We'll be back after these messages.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly, family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, woodcut and letterpress artist, Tom Killian. And I did want to let you know that Tom is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on Monday the 13th at 7:30 p.m. to talk about his new book, California's Wild Edge, which he's produced with Gary Snyder contributing poetry. So that's Monday the 13th of July. That's this Monday at 7:30. I'm going to be going, so I hope to see you there. It really is a beautiful book. So I wanted to ask you about the book, Tom. You say in California's Wild Edge that it's about finding the song of the California coast and that this is a personal quest. I'm wondering, what does finding the song of the coast mean to you?
Well, to me, finding the song of the California coast really was about spending a lot of time walking and swimming and surfing and boating all along its shores, from the seaside and the land side. And the song of the coast I'm most interested in is what comes from the land itself, and the edge between the sea and the land, and all the creatures and life that inhabits it, plant and animal. So it's not as much about my sort of human neighbors and the human history on the coast in terms of my art. My art is really, you know, about being in that place and sort of appreciating it for what it is. There's another side to the Song of the Coast, though, and that's the side that is our human life here. And that's probably better sung, that song, in words than in art.
Right.
And so along with my prints, there's about 60 of these woodcut prints, black and white and color, going back more than 40 years of the coast in this book. But there's also a lot of poetry. And so of all the art forms, the two that appeal to me the most are woodcut prints, as we've discussed this hour, and especially Japanese-style woodcut prints, and poetry, especially poetry that evokes the sense of place and being in the land and seascape of the coast. And so I spent a lot of time, really about 5 years, developing the text for this book, doing a lot of reading, going through the archives of some of the more famous poets that have lived along this coast, and trying to tell what I call the poetic history of the coast. And it's sort of a mixture of my interest in history with my interest in poetry and landscape art. And in there, I have poetry from maybe 25 different poets at least, and mentioned several more. And also, I have some excerpts from the diaries of people who traveled along the coast from both sea and land, especially in the early years when it was experienced much more in its wild self, because the technology of sailing on the sea and of moving along the land was a lot more limited. And I also try to put in as much as I could find that sort of has a some kind of literary reflection in it, from Native American cultures that existed along the coast before there was any written literature. So it's a big book. It has lot of qualities to it, but the song that it sings is the song of this wild edge between sea and land, and the sense of place.
Mm. And I mean, as evidenced in California's Wild Edge, you are also a beautiful writer as well as an artist. Do you think of yourself as a writer as well?
Well, I did a book called The Coast of California in 1979 that had my own sort of long poem of the coast in it. And I've dabbled in poetry a bit myself, and realized that really, my own sense of the landscape comes through better in my prints. Mm. So I, you know, I'm very happy to turn to other people's poetry. But yeah, I can write a sort of a history, I guess. You know, I did spend years of my life writing books on history and giving lectures on history, mostly African history. That was my...
Right, yeah.
I was a professor of African history for a while, and I've taught a lot of classes on California history and culture, especially up at San Francisco State in the late 1990s. I worked there for about 6 or 7 years.
I was going to ask you whether... you have a PhD in African history. As you say, you've taught in various universities. Does that part of your life feel separate from your art, or do they weave together for you?
Well, yeah... it's hard to know how all the experiences in your life, come out in whatever artistic sort of activities you do. But, of course, one's life is an integrated whole and everything interacts. The African part of my life only came through... in finished art, in one book I did called Walls, which is a travel book, and a last part of it is all about Africa. And I did do a bunch of woodcut prints in the 1980s about Africa. I spent a lot of the 1980s in Africa, so it was a big part of my life then.
Yeah. California's Wild Edge is published by Heyday, which is an independent nonprofit publisher with the stated aim of spreading awareness and celebration of California's many cultures, landscapes, and boundary-breaking ideas. I was wondering, how important is it for an artist such as yourself to have a relationship with a publisher like Heyday?
Well, I have to say, this book in particular, it's the third book I've done with Heyday, and the third book I've collaborated with Gary Snyder, the poet, on. This book in particular would absolutely not exist if it wasn't for Heyday. Malcolm Margolin, the publisher of Heyday and the genius behind it, who really started it from his bedroom, and all his family used to make their get their beds up off the floor on tops of... huge boxes of books.
Oh my goodness.
They literally were sleeping on the book stock of his initial publishing schemes. And it's gone from there to, having a staff of 20 people and its own beautiful little place on University Avenue in Berkeley now.
Mm.
Heyday, Malcolm wanted to do another book. And I had some ideas, but they weren't going to come to fruition for many years because it takes years and years to build up a stock of enough woodcut prints to create a book.
Yeah.
But I had all these prints of the coast, and I was ready to get away from my own poetry, which I'd written when I was in my very early 20s, and was still in the last version of The Coast of California, which was being sold at Bookshop Santa Cruz until last month. I finally sold the last box I had of those books exactly at the moment that new book came out.
Was that a hand-printed book?
You know, to move on to a new text, and I had a lot of new prints that hadn't been in that book, and Malcolm very kindly, got involved in making this project happen. So it's a joint project between Heyday and me, especially between Malcolm, who was really involved in this. He really helped get some of the poets on board with it and help me get permission to use some critical and difficult text to get a hold of about some of the authors. So, it's a Heyday project, and Heyday is a wonderful organization. And we just had the kickoff party for this book up in Point Reyes. We had 450 people there, and it was a benefit for Heyday. And they raised $20,000from that. So it's really very well supported by the community, especially up in the North Bay area, especially in Berkeley and Marin County, San Francisco. There's a tremendous amount of support for Heyday.
Yeah, well, I think, the way publishing is going generally, it is, very important to still have these independent publishers that are bringing out, beautiful books like this. I wanted to ask you, all art is about communication, and in representational art, obviously the artist is trying to communicate with an audience the reality of a certain scene. I'm wondering what you're trying to convey through your art beyond the subject itself, whether there's a sort of message that or energy that you want to come from your work that's beyond just, showing someone this is a beautiful landscape.
Well, I'll start with a caveat that you know, I'm a, I, of course, love California's natural world, and I want to preserve it. Its beauty. You know, I am absolutely not an eco-Nazi that thinks that there's no place for humans in the in the world, which is an absurd idea given the human population of the Earth. You know, so I see that this is a world that we share with other species, and but what I really do, from my heart, it's not conscious, but from my heart, I know that in a way, I'm trying to preserve in my mind the beauty of these places, the way I see them and I imagine them, for other people that might not experience it as much or see it the way I do, or I always think of future people on this coast, you know, although works on paper will only survive as long as there's a bourgeois society to preserve them, since they're pretty fragile. But, you know, it is a sense of a bit of an ethos of understanding and respecting the beautiful natural world we live in. That's where it's all coming from. But it's not overtly, you know, I'm doing this scene so that you know, it will be preserved in the, you know, some kind of environmental land trust or something. Although people have used my prints for all kinds of fundraising and things like that, and I'm always donating things to all kinds of organizations, because, you know, that's a great thing that can be done with art, is raising awareness about preserving ecosystems and, you know, the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you're certainly creating wonderful images of the coast for people who live here and also people who, you know, don't, so they can see what we're lucky enough to experience here. They're really stunning. I just wanted to let people know again that Tom is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on Monday, the 13th of July at 7:30. You're going to be giving a talk and then signing books. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah. I'm going to read a little from the new book and talk about it. Its process. I'll have some of my prints there. At Bookshop Santa Cruz always has my prints for sale, by the way, framed and unframed. And I've had my prints there for, well, it's probably over 40 years. I started selling them there when I was in college, and I graduated in 75 from UCSC, so it's probably been more than like 41 or 42 years.
Wow. Well, I encourage listeners to go along on Monday. We've come to the end of the show, but you can go on Monday and meet Tom and see his work and get his new wonderful book. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Tom. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ruth. I've really enjoyed getting to shout out about the new book.
Great. All right. Well, listeners, you can see Tom on Monday. I hope to see you there. And I'll see you next week otherwise.